From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Mexico's suddenly best-known and most successful film director, Alejandro González Iñárritu. His debut film, Amores Perros, about the people and the dogs of Mexico City, was nominated for an Academy Award. It's now out in theaters. Also, The Private, Paul Robeson. We talk with Paul Robeson Jr. about the man he knew as a father. He's just written part one of a memoir, The Undiscovered Paul Robeson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has passed legislation that would make it a federal crime to harm a fetus. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The House approved the Unborn Victims of Violence Act by a vote of 252 to 172. The vote would make it a separate federal crime to kill or injure a fetus during a federally designated violent crime against a pregnant woman. President Bush said Wednesday he would sign the bill if it reaches his desk. Supporters of the measure say it's needed to close a loophole in federal law that allows some violent criminals to avoid punishment for injuring a fetus or involuntarily terminating a pregnancy. But opponents said the bill's real intent is to establish legal status for fetuses that could be used later to attempt to overturn the Supreme Court's landmark abortion ruling, Roe v. Wade. Members defeated an alternative bill that would have established a new crime for violent attacks on pregnant women, but without recognizing the fetus as a person. Julie Rovner, NPR News, The Capitol.
A federal judge in Washington has refused to stop the Navy from resuming its bomb training exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. The Navy is set to start a new bomber training cycle tomorrow. The judge's ruling came in response to a complaint from Puerto Rico that the bombing exercises would violate the island's newly passed anti-noise law. Attorneys for the federal government say the Puerto Rican government passed the law for the sole purpose of stopping the Navy from using its controversial bombing range on Vieques Island. They say Puerto Rican officials put off enacting the legislation until just before the Navy was set to resume bombing in hopes of tying the training up with legal action. The International Monetary Fund called on the United States and the world's other leading industrial nations to stimulate their economies in its semi-annual World Economic Outlook report. Steve Beckner reports from Market News International.
IMF chief economist Michael Moussa acknowledged the global economy has slowed faster than he and his staff had anticipated as he released a report which revised down the IMF's previous forecast of world growth a full percent to 3.2% this year. It lowered its U.S. growth forecast by 1.7 percentage points to just 1.5%. The report praises the Federal Reserve for cutting interest rates, but said it should be prepared to do more. It also endorses tax reduction in the U.S. and says it should be front-loaded. The IMF report calls on the European Central Bank, which has not changed interest rates since it raised them last October, to begin cutting rates in Europe. And it urges Japan to continue stimulating its stagnant economy. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 62 points to close at 10,672 in active trading of 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 25 points, or 1.2%. This is NPR News. Last week, the arrival records of 22 million immigrants who entered the United States at Ellis Island became available on a website, ellisislandrecords.org. Since then, the online site has been overwhelmed with visitors. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
The website had 26 million visitors during the first 2.5 days of operation, but many more were unable to access the site. The site began operating with 10 servers and 3 backups, but had to add 10 more to handle the load. A spokesperson for the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation said Ellis Island was the top search term on the Lycos search engine last week. It was only the third time in Lycos's history that a new term became number one. The Ellis Island database consists of passenger manifests between 1892 and 1924. The information was transcribed and digitized by 12,000 volunteer members of the Mormon Church. The church has always encouraged genealogical research. It's estimated that 40% of Americans can trace an ancestor to Ellis Island. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Florida regulators are fining Verizon and its former marketing agency more than $3 million for using an illegal tactic called slamming to get customers for its long-distance service. Slamming is the practice of switching customers to a different long-distance service without their knowledge or approval. The Florida Attorney General said the tactic was used by Snyder Communications, which was the marketer for GTE, which is now known as Verizon. Attorneys alleged that Snyder employees and GTE employees forged the signatures of thousands of customers to switch them to GTE services. Snyder is owned by Daniel Snyder, the owner of the Washington Redskins. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novozoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. A Mexican movie that was nominated for Best Foreign Film is now opening in theaters to wonderful reviews. Amores Perros takes off like a rocket. In the first scene, we see two young men in a car racing through the streets of Mexico City. There's a bleeding dog in the back seat, and they're being chased by thugs in a pickup truck.
Métele, cabrón! Métele, güey!
The car crash is the central event of Amores Perros. We will learn the stories of the people involved in the accident in three interconnected subplots that take us into some of the very different worlds that coexist in Mexico City. The actors, most of them unknown in this country, the script, and Mexico City itself are all revelations. But most of the excitement surrounding the film focuses on its 37-year-old director, Alejandro González Iñárritu. He joins us on the line from Mexico City. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. How are you, Neil?
Very well. The title of your movie, Amores Perros, how does that translate?
Well, basically, it's supposed the first idea was like Love's a Beach. But I don't think there's a right, it's very hard to translate literally, but it will be something like tough loves or savage love or love as a dog, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Love that hurts. So it's a game of these two words. And obviously the dogs were used basically as metaphors of the main characters, I think.
Especially a dog named Kofi, who gets involved in dog fighting in the first sequence in the movie. I don't know where you found him, but what a tremendous canine actor!
Yeah, I think we got a good trainer, you know, and the actors really work a lot with the dogs. They train a lot. They feed them like two times a week. So we create a very big and strong relation between the actors and the animals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the movie in some way, because it's about a lot of things, but in some way it's about that. And we try to really explore the nature of the dog that is very close to the nature of human beings and how intense and how close a relation between a man and a dog can be, you know?
This one dog, Kofi, is turned into a killer. He's put into the pit to fight against other dogs. And now, I know a lot of people have been upset by the dog fighting scenes, and I have to say that I was pretty relieved when at the end of the picture I did see the statement on the film that no animals were harmed in the making of the picture.
Yeah, I think it's not a movie about that, but it's only like 18 seconds of real explicit dogfight. That is one of the context of one of the stories of one of the characters. So it's a little piece, but obviously it's very high impact. I try to take out the superficial way of how Disney movies sometimes put the dogs like that you mm-hmm. all immediately refer that they are playing. When we shoot this, we take care a lot. I love dogs. I have a dog. I treat maybe worse the actors than the animals. but what I can assure you is that any dog was harmed. You know, the dogs was treated very good. They were playing, and we put like kind of a little fish line, like invisible bustle, and they were playing. But with the handheld camera and the audio design, you swear that they are. And I was really trying to make the build up of the scene very stressful for when this happens in front of the eyes of the of the audience, they jump like in an horror film. That, but the animals were really well treated, you know.
It's interesting. There's a lot of violence in your picture, but that most of the attention is focused on this very brief dogfighting sequence and not on the violence that happens to the people.
Yeah, I think it's not a violent movie. I think it's an intense movie. Mexico City is a 21 million city. People living here is an anthropological experiment, so it's very intense. So I think it's more violent to watch the news in the night or to read the newspapers, you know. I think it's basically a very entertaining film with three love stories with people that love and learn how to love. But I don't think it's the kind of violence, that is used as entertainment. People that kill people and laugh and make a punchline and sleep with the most beautiful girl in the night. I think I try to really explore the violence in the way that I have lived in my own city. I have been victim of that, and I try to take out the frivolous part of the mm-hmm. violence. I think it's a violence with a consequence, but a very painful consequence in the human beings.
Mexico City is almost a character in this movie.
Well, if you notice, you never can recognize the city in the film. You know, I never use this kind of setup, kind of scenes when you can recognize some.
There's no picture postcard shots.
Exactly, but I think more than you can see the city. I think you can smell the city, and I was really obsessed about that. I think a good film should smell too. So I think the people really can recognize the city by the smell of the textures and the walls and the people, you know? That's what I was trying to get it. These stories can happen in any city in the world, you know?
And when did you come to the realization that the car crash was going to be the linchpin, the thing that held the film together?
Always. The car crash was always, you know, the image for us as the metaphor of the vulnerability or how fragile the human beings are, you know. An accident can happen to anybody, even to Lady D that died in a car crash, you know, to anybody, Mexicans, American, handsome, kings, servants. It's something that can happen and change the life for everybody. So that main point, the car crash, was like in the center of this universe and was like a big bang that explodes and affects to all the planets, you know.
Alejandro González Iñárritu is on the line with us from Mexico City. We're talking about his movie Amores Perros. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Did you grow up in Mexico City?
Yes, I have been living here all my life. 37 years I've been living here. And basically I came from radio as a DJ in a radio station, rock and roll radio station. And then I became a creative director. I became a promoter and producer of rock concerts, big rock concerts, and then creative director, writing and directing ideas for TV commercials. And basically, and then I studied two years theater.
Uh-huh. TV commercials, is that where you learn the craft that you've used now?
Exactly. I think the craft I learned in that, I think. You know, the TV commercial sometimes give you a lot of biases, bad things. But at the same time, if you are aware, and I always use the advertising commercial as, you know, as rehearsals and exercises for going to feature films. So I always was training with that. So the ability to synthesize the stories is a very good exercise in the commercial, I think. And you learn a lot about the skills, lens, you know, techniques, you know, genres. So you can play a lot. You learn.
You said you started out with the idea of learning what you needed to do to make feature films. The Mexican film industry has been a sleepy place in recent years. For a long time, it was controlled by a government board, and you had to get permission to go make a movie.
Yeah, it was very hard to make films in Mexico the last 20 years, I think. The last 3 years, it's became better. There are more private investors. The audience, there are more theaters in the cities. The people are more, you know, the Mexican audience wants more Mexican films, you know. So it's been changing. It has been a little change, but it's not radical. I think it will take 5-10 years maybe to get an industry, you know. But it's getting better, I think, right now. Yeah, but used to be very hard.
Is there an international Hispanic market? I mean, does Amores Perros translate perfectly and play well in Spain and Argentina?
Yeah, I think this film played well. Normally, it's not a rule. Normally, it's very hard that an Argentinian film or a Mexican film or a Spanish film play well in another countries, even when they speak Spanish. It's very hard. This movie made well. It's not a mainstream hit, you know, mm-hmm. but well made very well, a good box office, I think. And that's the only exit, the only way that we can gain and we can begin to make better films, I think, if we find a way to make a international Spanish market, I think. But it's happening, it's begin to happen, I think, but it's very hard because we are different cultures, you know. Even when we speak Spanish, we are very, very different people.
My guest is Alejandro González Iñárritu, the director of the new movie Amores Perros. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Now more with Mexican director Alejandro González Iñárritu. What is the origin of this passion that you have for making movies? Who were the people who influenced and inspired you?
I can tell you that basically the other day I was thinking that, and I think I was more inspired by musicians than from filmmakers. You know?
Really?
I can tell you that I'm more inspired in, you know, in Genesis, the rock band, the English rock band, in the beginning with Peter Gabriel and Jess and Led Zeppelin and Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd and The Who. That kind of bands really, really created in myself a conscious of about, you know, because in the beginning of all these bands, they were playing music, but was more than music. Was an attitude, a way of life, a concept. They play like, you know, these big albums that have a concept, a big story. So I always was really interested. And when I heard music, I always, you know, make stories in my mind. So that was the beginning of my real need to tell stories in image. But the music really, you know, was the beginning of everything, I think.
It's interesting because I'm reading the critics who wrote about your film. Most of them loved it, but a lot of them made say, you know, here's about a Quentin Tarantino and here's a nod to Luis Buñuel.
It's very funny. Yeah, I don't know why the critics always has to refer a film to another film, you know. But I don't think I have nothing to do with Tarantino, you know. I think that the violence of Tarantino is used in a way that I hate that because it's entertaining violence. And I think it's a very frivolous, you know, it's frivolous, you know. I hate that kind of a statement that you can kill people and laugh. For me, that I have lived in a violent city, there's nothing to laugh about violence. So I cannot use that for entertain people in a very ironic, you know, way. And I think Tarantino is a very talented director, but the statement that he has with the violence, I cannot take. And I think that this film doesn't have to do nothing with Tarantino, you know. He doesn't invent the three stories in a film. It was used by Kurosawa in 51, you know, and in literature we were inspired in William Faulkner in The Sound and Fury. That is a novel that play with that fragmented time, you know. So I don't think there's something that can relate for me to that kind of films.
Now, you were a rock and roll disc jockey. Did that play a role in picking the music for this picture?
Yeah, I think my mind. I'm a frustrated musician. I always want to be a musician. So I play the guitar. I have a rock band's group and everything. But I don't know. Suddenly the radio crossed my life and everything happens. But my way of thinking is always very musical, and I think the rhythm is something very important for a movie or for a novel or for anything. Rhythm. So I always think very musical. Well, so when I was directing with music, and the music that I take, some of the songs that I take for this film was very important when I was playing in the radio, you know, when I was a DJ.
What songs in particular, or what artists in particular, were important that you include in the movie?
Well, I think there's a great Mexican and Argentinians and Spanish band. Mexicans, there are Café Tacuba, that is a great, great, great Mexican rock band. Control Machete, that is another very classic and contemporary, important rock Mexican band. Mm-hmm. I think the soundtrack is very, it's incredible because it's a double soundtrack. In some there's the score, and another is another songs that were composed after the film was done. So it's a good compilation of what is happening in the Spanish rock and roll, I think.
And there's also a bow to your old passions about English rock bands, the Hollies, Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress.
Exactly. To tell you the truth, my idea when I was editing the film, I did that scene with Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Creedence Clearwater, yes.
Exactly. So I did a song with that, but the rights was really, really, really expensive. So at the end, I used the Hollies, which I like, mm-hmm. but I prefer. And I was trying to use Jimi Hendrix, but it was very expensive. So the Hollies was my last choice, to tell you the truth. But I like it. I think it has to do something with that era, with that context of this character, I think.
One of the amazing things about this picture is that for an American who's not familiar with any of these actors, it's almost like this film bursts onto the scene fully grown, like Athena coming from the head of Zeus. It's these very, very accomplished performers that we've never seen before.
Yeah, I try to use, I try to use new actors. Mostly of the Mexican actors, they are not known in the United States, but even in Mexico, they are not well known. Emilio Echeverría, the Chivo, the Goat, is a very well-known theater actor. Mm-hmm. And the guy, Octavio, is the first story, this mm-hmm. young man that is an amazing actor, is a theater actor. He was studying in England. And basically, all of the actors are theater actors, which I love because they have a very incredible discipline, they have another techniques, I think.
But you went to the theater as opposed to using people who would have worked on television or people that you would have used in commercials.
Exactly. Some of them I have used in commercial. The first guy, Octavio, I mm-hmm. used in the commercial, and I fall in love with this guy. I say, when I make a film with a young guy, I will make the film with this guy, So, and some of them were playing, and I went to the place, and I respect them a lot. I really love actors. I think I it's one of my favorite things to make a film. The best part of the trip is the shooting and to work with actors. For me, I enjoy a lot that.
That's the most fun.
For me, yes, yeah. For me, shooting the film is the most fun. Because when you are dreaming and you are developing and you are writing, you are it's a little anxious. But when you already have the idea and you begin to put that in a set, you have a camera and two actors that really put the spirit and the flesh in what the little lyrics are saying. It's amazing. It's like magic. That's what this film's about. It's magic. People with real feelings, it's something magical. I really love that part of the process, I think.
Later on in the production process, I understand that you also had some help. Some colleagues who also work in the Mexican film business came in to work on the film with you.
Yeah, I think in the editing process, when I was like 6 months in my home editing, trying to put. So I have my first cut, and I knew that I had to take out like 10, 15, I don't know, more minutes. But I didn't know where. So
excruciating those last cuts.
Exactly. So Guillermo del Toro, who direct Mimic, mm-hmm. and which is direct Blade 2 right now in Czechoslovakia, is a Mexican director. He's a friend of mine. So he came to my house, and I meet him by telephone, and I didn't meet him by personally. So he arrived. He's a fat guy. He's a very funny, talented fat guy that arrived to my home, stayed 3 days, eat all my refrigerator. We laugh a lot, we discuss a lot, we work a lot without sleep 3 days, and he helped me really to find out where these 10 minutes should go out. So I appreciate that a lot. And and when we were developing the script, I have some reading with some another directors, as Alfonso Cuarón, who direct Little Princess and Great Expectations. And he helped me a lot to find, you know, some mistakes in the script and some, you know. So that's a very good process, I think. I think was very helpful to find your, you know, your friends, directors that you admire, that helps you in little details that really change all the things, I think.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on another story with the same screenwriter of Amores Perros that is called Guillermo Arriaga. We are writing, we are developing, we have like 1 year and a half developing this script. We have the first draft of a script that is called 21 Grams.
It's not a drug picture, is it?
No. No. It's 21 grams is the weight of the soul. When you die, when everybody dies, immediately you lose 21 grams. So it's the weight of life, you know, in some way. So it's, again, like, it's a very painful story, but at the same time, it has a lot of hope, a lot of humanity. I'm interested in as an Amores Perros, you know, real stories, weak characters that really, you know, that really can learn a lot through a painful process and be better at the end, you know? I don't like hard and strong characters that can kill people and smile, and you know, I cannot relate with that kind of people. I relate with weak people. I feel that I'm weak as a human being. I'm vulnerable, so I like those characters. So this story is about that, the how fragile we are, but there's a lot of hope at the end, and it's about that. I'm working on that, and I'm reading some stuff too, I think.
Well, all we can do is wish you the best of luck.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, and thank you for the interest, and I'm glad that you like Amores Perros.
Alejandro González Iñárritu, Amores Perros, is playing in theaters around the country. Now let's hear a song from the soundtrack. This is Si Señor by Control Machete. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Y creciendo maduro en mi tierra, listo para volar mientras mi gente espera. Espigas que voy yo sembrando para ver si germinan. Viento del norte, pensamiento y vida. A San Pedro lo traigo entre el aliento y saliva. Que suelto cada momento que siento correcto y lo hago completo y directo. Sí, señor. Presente, esperando en represente. Baja por las noches, me arrulla yo inconsciente en mi vientre. Los segundos pasados, cargados, tatuados en mi espalda, empapados, aunados a espasmos de llanto y de risa. He andado sin pausa, sin prisa, así de lento el momento. Y no termina así de lento, cruzando entre las.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Genius Every Day by Michael J. Gelb. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, an intimate portrait of Paul Robeson. We talk with Paul Robeson Jr. about how he wants his father to be understood. That's the subject of his new biography, The Undiscovered Paul Robeson.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross.
Soft, you! A word or two before you go. I have done the state some service, and they know it. No more of that. I pray you in your letters, when you shall these unlucky deeds relate, speak of me as I am. Nothing extenuate, nor set down aught in malice.
The final speech of Othello and the magnificent voice of Paul Robeson. Shakespeare's Moor was perhaps his most famous role, but Robeson the actor is also remembered as the personification of Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones, and he stopped the show when he sang Old Man River in Showboat. Paul Robeson was a renowned concert performer, too, who based his repertoire in spirituals but came to include a wide range of folk and classical music. He was one of the great artists of the 20th century and among the most controversial. Paul Robeson Jr. has written a biography of his famous father called The Undiscovered Paul Robeson. This volume covers the period from his birth in 1898 to 1939. It reminds us that he first came to national attention as an athlete. Paul Robeson was an All-American end for Rutgers College, maybe the best football player in the country in 1917 and 1918. Here's a reading from the book that describes how he had to overcome the racism of his own teammates before he could even make the varsity.
He had made a clean, hard tackle and momentarily lay face down with his arms outstretched to catch his breath. Just then, passing by on his way back to the huddle, a varsity halfback named Frank Kelly deliberately stomped on the fingers of Paul's right hand. The bones didn't break, but the pain was excruciating. Enraged even more by the insult than by his pain, Paul leapt to his feet. But he did not attack Kelly. Instead, he harnessed the immense energy of his anger and coiled his body in preparation for the next play. In his mind, he focused on avenging an insult not just to himself, but to the entire black race. The next play was run directly at him, with Kelly carrying the ball. Paul uncoiled, hurling aside the blockers, and drove his shoulder into the onrushing Kelly with a thump heard across the practice field. Then, in a single coordinated motion, he planted his feet widely, wrapped his arms tightly around Kelly, and with an explosive effort heaved Kelly up over his head. He was in full control of his rage, but only he knew that. His murderous body language and facial expression frightened all the onlookers who feared he might kill Kelly. Coach Sanford screamed the first thing that came into his mind, "Robeson, you're on the varsity." Paul silently dropped the terrified halfback to the ground and stalked off the field holding his injured hand. He recalled this incident as a symbol of the savagery of America's popular culture. At the time, he experienced a liberating revelation. It was as if he had used the energy of his rage to convince a group of hostile white men that he might kill at least one of them in self-defense if they attacked him. For the first time in his life, he had cast off his father's cautionary strictures about never angering white people. At last, he had been able to savor the heady feeling of siding with his rebellious brother, Reed. And that was a defining moment which he repeated to me over and over. Not afraid to die, and in the end, if you have to save your life, not afraid to kill.
You talked about his father's teachings. His father, a minister in Princeton, New Jersey, who was later lost his job as a result of politics in Princeton and racism, and then finally got another pastor at this time in the AME Zion Church. But he insisted that Paul, and I'm quoting you here, he insisted that Paul must never appear to be challenging the claim of white superiority. Climb up if you can, he would say, but always show you are grateful. Above all, do nothing to give them cause to fear you. Was this an expression of someone who was himself vastly more familiar with slavery and someone who was experiencing at that very time
the rash of lynchings throughout the country.
That's absolutely correct. But from generation to generation, there are those who, like my grandfather, Paul's father, took that tack, and as a people, we had to take that tack in order to survive. But there always have been those who, at the right time in the right place, have defied white superiority. There's not only Frederick Douglass, after all, there was Nat Turner. And my father was a little bit Nat Turner. There's a place and a time. So at that moment was the first time in his life that he went beyond his father's limitations, and he never went back. That is, metaphorically, not literally, of course, he never went back to this fear of, I can't go right against the system. He, from then on, when he felt it was the right time, was capable to conquer both fear and anger, and in a disciplined way, challenge the whole scheme of things.
Despite his experience of racism, and that one incident you told us about was hardly the only one, he was regarded as apolitical when he was first in living in Harlem. But you take care to point out that in those early years, it wasn't that he was not paying attention. He was listening to people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey. Listening and learning, do you think?
Learning and choosing. For example, philosophically, he identified with W.E.B. Du Bois. He rejected outright the nationalism of Garvey, and he rejected outright the assimilationist views of James Weldon Johnson and subsequent assimilationists. So he was making choices at the time, and as an artist, he felt in the 20s, certainly, and into the early 30s, the way to make his point was through culture and not through political debate. Mm-hmm. He was very political, if you think of culture as political. He redefined the black male image, for example, in the theater, from a caricature to a human being. He made the spiritual an art form, accepted art form in America, and he embodied the traditions of the black working class as distinct from the traditions of the black middle class entrepreneurial class. So he even then, culturally speaking, was engaging in what a Marxist might call the class struggle, only not explicitly. He felt, and besides, he was not a movement person. He was an inspirer. He wasn't an organizational person, let's say, like Martin Luther King. He came to sing at meetings, not to make speeches. Seems like a contradiction, but it isn't when you think about it.
Paul Robeson Jr. is the author of The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, the first of what will be a two-volume biography. We're going to take a short break now. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Robeson Jr. His new biography of his famous father is The Undiscovered Paul Robeson. It's subtitled An Artist's Journey, 1898 to 1939. As a young man, still studying law at Columbia University, Paul Robeson took his first roles on stage and found his voice singing spirituals. Yeah. Deep River, recorded in 1926, sung by Paul Robeson with his longtime accompanist and collaborator Lawrence Brown on piano. Paul Robeson Jr., this was in the middle of the jazz age. Weren't spirituals more than a little bit out of fashion?
Indeed they were, specifically among black people, certainly among the black middle class, who felt you're supposed to be singing lieder and classical things like all the other European concert singers to prove that you can do this. These are just sort of folk songs. It's too crude. You shouldn't be doing that, Paul. It's embarrassing. It's fascinating that he converted in his first concert tour the black middle class to re-accept, to re-enter their own culture and identify once again with the spirituals, because he sang them with such originality as they were meant to be sung. He sort of reclaimed an important part of American culture.
He was also criticized by some black performers who said he was doing this the wrong way. He wasn't listening to Debussy when he was singing spirituals.
That's correct. And he simply said this is an original folk art which is as important artistically as Bach, Debussy, or any other music, and pointed out that the greatest composers, including Bach, Debussy, and Mozart and many others, used folk themes and folk music as the basis for their, quote, more sophisticated music.
Paul Robeson had a lot of trouble throughout this part of his career being torn between the attractions of the commercial world, and he appeared for a while in the great musical review written by U.B. Blake and Noble Sissel, Shuffle Along, for example. This is not something you associate with Paul Robeson.
Well, that's very much a significant point. His early career was the conflict of remaining pure to his cultural traditions and getting on the performing artist's radar screen in the country. If you got no audience, you might as well be singing on the street corner. So that was an immense conflict. What does one do? Well, he made the obvious compromises in order to get on the map. He did Shuffle Along as a means for not only making money, but getting on the radar screen, so to speak. His point was that where did he want to go? Did he want to continue to be a big star in vaudeville and go on to musical shows and whatnot, or did he want to go into the classical theater and the classical concert stage? He chose the latter and used the former only as a way to get his foot in the door. His point was, overall, when he looked back, it's not so much the compromises you make on the way up, and he made many. I mean, he sang all kinds of popular songs, including some darky songs, Mammy's Little Baby Loves Shortening Bread and things like that, as well as Deep River, in order to become a popular recording artist. Then he had a huge audience to speak to. If he hadn't, he'd had no audience. So he was not at all apologetic about that, even when he was criticized quite sharply in the late 20s, early 20s for that matter, and in the 30s by both the left and the more militant wing of the civil rights movement, and especially by the nationalists. He shrugged that off. He said, you got to get from here to there in steps. The point was, when you become powerful, when you have this huge audience, then you have an obligation to use it for the good and not do this garbage anymore.
One role he did not take, and this almost comes to a shock, you associate the role so much with Paul Robeson, it's almost a shock to realize he was not in the original cast of Showboat.
Correct, and because he didn't like the lyrics and he was trying to get out of it. But then I came along, I was born in 1927, he searched around, he had to make some money, so he took the role when it opened in London and swallowed his pride and sang the lyrics, although he sang it in a different way than it was originally written. He brought his own spin to it, so to speak, and he became an instant star. So that's an example of what I'm saying. Yeah, the mother, by the way, who was very shrewd in these areas and was a great help to him in his early career, said, look, take the doggone part, sing it the way it was, and he turned it down. No, I'm not going to do that. Later on, I quote him in a letter saying to Mother, you're absolutely right. I was a fool not to do some of this stuff. But fortunately, he was very lucky and got the role in London. Of course, the rest is history.
One of the London critics, Paul Robeson, had already appeared on stage in London before this, noted that Robeson not only stole the show, but somehow the production had been contrived to give this enormous stage presence a non-speaking part.
Dad was amazingly adept and skillful at using his body, which was an athlete's body, on stage, and I don't think people are too aware of that dimension of his acting. And part of his training, by the way, as I describe in the book, was his first film was a film made by a black filmmaker named Oscar Michaud called Body and Soul, which was a silent film in which my father had to play two roles in the first film he'd ever done. And he couldn't use his voice. It was silent. So he had to learn to act. And that was really the crucible in which he learned how to use his body and facial expressions as an actor and not rely on his voice.
For some people, your father's legacy will always be tainted by his association with the Soviet Union, a place he never publicly criticized.
Absolutely right.
In the 1930s, even as they're approaching the period of this book, by the 1930s, some of the excesses, if you will, of the Soviet system had certainly come to light.
Call them crimes, which they were.
I mean, indeed.
Excesses is kind of a euphemism. What I do in the book is, through his own words, demonstrate once and for all that there's no way anyone can say that he didn't know what was happening during the purges in the Soviet Union or what kind of person Stalin was. He knew chapter and verse. I knew as a 10-year-old going to school with the children of the people being purged. So even a 10-year-old is not blind and deaf. So whatever anybody wants to say, he knew what was going on in the 1930s in the Soviet Union under Stalin. The crimes, not just the excesses.
And
he never criticized that, then or later. So the only question is, why not?
There you go.
Now, maybe the easiest way is just to read a brief excerpt from the preface where I deal with that. The media nurtured myth that his political persecution stemmed from a love affair with communism, or that he was duped by Russian or American communists, has always been aimed at obfuscating his dedication to the goal of immediate and full freedom for his people. The truth is that my father was never a communist, nor did he ever seriously contemplate joining the Communist Party. His defense of the Soviet Union and his refusal to abandon his communist friends did not stem from a fascination with left-wing ideology or from personal pride. Rather, these decisions were based on his love of Russian culture and his conviction that the Soviet Union and communists in general were the most reliable opponents of Nazism, colonialism, and racism. And I might add that communists in the United States and elsewhere, in his view, were the best allies of African Americans, and that was proven throughout history. So that in terms of how you behave as and any African-American understood that then and understands it now, you don't criticize your allies when you're fighting your enemy. And for him, the right wing of the United States, the system and the culture developed in the South with slavery and the aftermath, was the worst enemy of progressive mankind and of black people specifically, outside of Hitler's Nazis, and they were cousins, if not the brothers, of Hitler's Nazis. He believed it. I think history has proved it, and I believe it. There are a lot of people that upsets, on the left, never mind, on the right. But that is an African-American attitude based on the history of slavery and racism in the U.S., more than, quote, a left-wing attitude.
Paul Robeson, Jr., more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Robeson, Jr. He's the author of a new book, The Undiscovered Paul Robeson, the first of a two-volume biography of his father. Tell us, the growing up as the son of a famous man is not the easiest thing in the world. This couldn't have been, by no stretch of the imagination, did you have anything approaching what anybody would call a normal childhood?
No, you're quite right about that. But one thing I'll tell you, it certainly was not dull. It certainly was not dull. I mean, it was one hell of a trip in one sense. Yes, there was I missed him a lot when I was a little kid because he wasn't around much. He was on tour. I was being taken care of by my grandmother.
It's interesting you say your first memory of your father is, in fact, his voice coming out of a Victrola.
Exactly. And I guess the next one was one day, I must have been, I don't know, maybe I wasn't barely 2 years old, but anyway, I remember vaguely, even today, one day that the voice came from up there somewhere above my head. It wasn't the usual place, and there's this huge shoe there, you know, the 14, and you know, at a two-year-old level, I put it together. Oh, hey, that's the real one. And my only vague memory is just this wonderful sound of this deep, gentle voice and these huge hands, which were very gentle, and then this big smile and the big eyes with a lot of this wonderful, benevolent image and feeling. So there was a great feeling of security. At the same time, I was would get pretty angry at him as a little kid. He's never around, you know. Little kids, my father, I own him. Who the heck is the Prince of Wales or Nehru or somebody? Well, hell, I'm number one here, Dad.
Don't you understand? The universe centers right here.
Right. So he was a very fun guy to be around.
The experience of being separated that much from your parents, you must have understood that they were special and that I guess in a way you were too.
That's true, but one thing he gave me is a sense of myself. Looking back, it's over an entire lifetime. His point was, do whatever you want to do. Don't copy anybody else, and especially don't copy me. He had a great sense of humor. So he said, well, you know, if you want to sing and act, great, but you're not going to beat me at Othello or Old Man River. Do something, you know. don't try to beat me at that. So he always gave, not just me, but other people, a sense of themselves. He was, in that sense, an emotional empowerer rather than sort of an awe-inspiring suppressor, as many, quote, great, unquote, people are.
You did eventually follow his steps onto the football field, at least. You must have had many temptations to try to go on stage or sing.
No, I never wanted any part of that. I mean, the price he paid for being an artist and a public figure, the personal price he paid in terms of giving up a personal life, I was never ready to do for any reason, even political. And in some ways, as an organizational political person, I was more political than he. But I wasn't about to sacrifice my personal life in the way he had to do what he did. I guess it was from, you know, seeing the price that the family paid, not just him, but especially him.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, he had to live up to a living legend, and that is he had to live up to a public which expected him to be bigger than life. There is no such thing as bigger than life, as he would impress upon me often. So that's an immense burden. And he said when he retired and became what people said, well, he's a recluse. No, he had had enough of being a public figure, and he wasn't about to be someone's wise elder and some kind of living icon. He'd done his job, he'd finished, and he wasn't about to give up 1 second of his private life after his retirement. So I remember him saying, when he was about 60, you know, I hope I don't live to be an old man. I have a heart attack or something and go quickly because I wouldn't know how to be an old man. after my public career is gone, because nobody would accept me as just a person who's not some kind of icon. So, in a sense, he sacrificed being able to be old. I wasn't willing to do that. Very few people, you see, only people who have a divine mission like a Robeson or a King or a Malcolm, Latter-day Malcolm, or a Frederick Douglass or a Nat Turner, I'm not quite up to that. I have to say, very few people are.
Paul Robeson Jr., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Robeson Jr. is the author of The Undiscovered Paul Robeson. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Megan Howell, and Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
And I shall hear, though soft you tread above me, and all my grave will warm a sweeter be. For you will bend and tell me that you shall sleep in peace until you come to me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Crown Business Books Division, publisher of The Customer Revolution, How to Thrive When Customers Are in Control, by Patricia B. Siebold, with Ronnie T. Marshak and Jeffrey M. Lewis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, director Joel Schumacher on the ups and downs of making blockbusters and low-budget movies. His film Tigerland is out on video. Also, Greg Kinnear on the secret to bad acting. He plays a soap opera star in the film Nurse Betty. It's out on video. Kinnear's latest film is Someone Like You. Join us on the next Fresh Air.